Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions, a local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
New Hampshire Center for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapies, providing outpatient, evidence-based, specialty behavioral health and substance use disorder services. NHCCBT.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today, the politics of healthcare. In Washington, repeal and replace dominated the debate this summer and fall as Republicans sought to fulfill campaign promises to get rid of the Affordable Care Act and come up with something better. But those efforts didn't come quite close enough, including a last-ditch attempt that crumbled about a week ago. So now, what? Are we back to square one? With so-called Obamacare still the law of the land? The answer is complicated. And so today in The Exchange, longtime healthcare reporter Julie Rovner is here to help us untangle it all. She's chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and we welcome your questions and comments. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Julie Rovner joins us from Washington. And Julie, welcome back. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, now your expertise, Julie, is following, you know, the politics of healthcare on Capitol Hill. But I want to focus away from the Hill for a few minutes with you. Repeal and replace, all the bills going up and down. We'll cover that. But where is the bipartisanship on this issue, Julie? From your reporting and other reporters, it seems like there's more agreement bubbling up from the states. So what's going on there?
There absolutely is. The states know what they need to make their insurance markets work. For all the rhetoric about how the Affordable Care Act was a federal takeover of health insurance, states still do most of the regulating. And we actually saw on Capitol Hill last month when the sort of nascent bipartisan effort was trying to get off the ground, they had in insurance commissioners and governors, Republicans and Democrats, and they pretty much surprisingly agreed on what they, the states, needed to make this individual insurance market stable. I think it kind of threw Senator Lamar Alexander, the Republican, trying to push this effort for a little bit of a loop because it wasn't really what he expected. But they were. I was surprised at the unanimity amongst the Republicans and the Democrats that were there about ways to what would it take to stabilize the market and what Congress could do to help facilitate that.
Yeah, so you and others have called these state insurance commissioners sort of the healthcare leaders that you've never heard of, but they are emerging as a force. What are they telling lawmakers that they want?
Well, they've always been there as a force. It's just people are starting to notice them now. You know, one of the things that they want is for the Trump administration to sort of stop actively undermining the law. That's one of the things that's going on. There's a big fight. It's got to go do with a court, with a lawsuit that predated Trump, but it has to do with billions of dollars in subsidies for low-income people, not subsidies for premiums, but helping low and moderate-income people pay their out-of-pocket costs, their deductibles and their co-payments and their co-insurance, which under the Affordable Care Act can be thousands of dollars. And the insurance companies are required under their contract to provide this help. The federal government is required under the law to pay them back. There's a technical glitch about whether that money was officially appropriated. And basically, the administration every month is saying it might or might not make these payments. That's had a huge impact on the market. A number of companies have dropped out. Others have raised their premiums. We also have the administration kind of waffling about whether it's going to enforce the individual mandate, the requirement that most people either have insurance or pay a fine. And of course, if that's not going to be enforced, healthier people are less likely to sign up for insurance, which again prompts insurance companies to either drop out of the market or raise rates. So there's all this uncertainty. And basically what the Republican and Democratic governors and the Republican and Democratic insurance commissioners came and said, we need certainty. That's the one thing the insurance industry needs to go forward. This is not about helping the insurance industry per se. It's about having insurance available for people who need it.
So governors and their insurance commissioners pretty much on the same page, Julie, saying what they want from Washington?
Pretty close to it. I mean, you know, they don't agree on everything. Obviously, governors and you know, from Republican and Democratic governors aren't going to agree on everything. And even insurance commissioners aren't going to agree on everything. But they agree on more than they disagree on right now.
Well, and we have heard so much about huge premium price hikes for some people in some states. Who are we talking about here, Julie? And just as important, who are we not talking about?
But we're not actually talking about most of the population. Most people still get their insurance from an employer or from someone in their family's employer or directly from the government through the Medicare or Medicaid program. What we have are what's sort of left in the insurance market are about 17.5 million people. That includes people who buy their insurance on these health insurance exchanges and people who buy their own because they make too much to get a subsidy. So for whatever reason, they buy it through a broker or directly from an insurance company. And, you know, of those 17.5 million people, about 60% of them get some kind of help paying their premiums. About 40% of them don't. So the people who are really feeling the brunt of these increases are that's the 40% of the 17 million people who are paying, you know, when we see these 40 and 50% increases, they're paying that. They're paying sticker price for insurance. It's a lot of money, and a lot of them just can't afford it.
So not a lot of people. And what types of people do these tend to be, Julie? Like, you know, self-employed entrepreneurs? Or, you know, who aren't getting insurance through Medicare, Medicaid, and their employer?
Yeah, there's sort of two kinds of people. The people who are self-employed, those are the people who are always in the individual market. They are consultants and architects and doctors and dentists, but also owners of small businesses. They may send their employees out to get insurance either from Medicaid if they don't earn very much or on the exchanges. And they also, because they're, you know, they don't have a group plan, they buy their own. So there's a lot of small business types, a lot of people who are self-employed, and then people who work for small businesses that don't offer insurance, as I mentioned. So it's sort of a combination of people who work for themselves or who work for a business that's small enough that it doesn't have to offer insurance.
So these are the people who might face huge premium hikes. A small slice, but obviously these hikes are enormous. The insurance companies and Democrats have been saying all this uncertainty caused by the Trump administration, they say, is causing us to raise our rates. Help me out with that, though, Julie. I thought that insurance rates were largely set by the cost of healthcare, who's accessing it, how much they're accessing, you know, rising technology, you know, maybe you have the latest and greatest machinery in your hospital and that costs more. How does politics raise healthcare premium costs?
Yeah, well, basically, you know, health insurance premiums, you're right, are fundamentally a result of how much healthcare costs in the area where you're located. And that's why in different parts of the country, things are much more expensive. Or sometimes, you know, in places that have done a good job controlling costs, controlling technology, like Minnesota, they might be a little bit less expensive. But the other thing that they are a function of is who was in the pool, basically, if you will. Insurers don't cross-subsidize. They don't say, well, we're doing really well in the employer market and we'll make that, you know, so we can lower rates in the individual market. They basically look at each market by itself. And if everybody in the individual market in that state is less than perfectly healthy, the more they're going to have to pay out and the more they're going to have to, you know, basically raise rates to cover that. And that's why what you see is that, you know, employer rates are going up very slowly. We're in a time of relatively slow healthcare inflation. There's still a debate about why that is, but the fact is it's true that employer rates went up like 3% last year. Individual rates are going up much more rapidly, not so much because the cost of healthcare, the underlying cost of healthcare is going up, but because the people that they're insuring are using much more of that healthcare. It means they're not getting enough healthy people into that pool to sort of offset the losses. So we're at this sort of odd place where there is some, people talk about there's some stability in the individual market, and there is, and partly it's because insurance companies are now charging so much that they're able to break even, but it's way too much for most people to actually afford to use their insurance.
I want to pick up on something you just said, Julie. Insurers don't I can't remember the exact word you use, cross-pollinate or pool.
Cross-subsidize.
So why not? I mean, if I'm running a business and my, you know, I run a little store and my bread sales are, you know, wonderful and going through the roof, then maybe I can afford to subsidize my cheese sales. I mean, it's not a great analogy, but I don't really understand why they segment it like that.
Well, because they can. I mean, they don't cross-subsidize because they don't have to. And remember, many, if not most, I forget the exact ratio is, insurance companies are for-profit entities. Even the nonprofit entities have to make enough to break even. And they have traditionally done this by market. There's usually an individual. Sometimes the individual and small group market are one. Sometimes they're separate. But the employer market, the regular sort of large employer market, is always separate, which is why you saw a lot of these sort of big insurers that most people have heard of come into the market who had not really traditionally been players in the individual market, didn't really know how it worked, and, you know, beat a hasty retreat, if you will. Aetna is a good example of that, that came into a bunch of markets to see if it could make some money. And when it decided it couldn't, it got back out. So they basically can do that. And a lot of them do. And they have, you know, they have shareholders to answer to. And they have, you know, there's some, the nonprofits have a community service requirement. But the for-profits don't necessarily have that.
Well, one more question about the insurance companies, Julie, and then I want to go to our listeners. So insurance companies have been raising their rates on this individual Obamacare market for this small slice of people, saying that all this political uncertainty is making them do so. But I was just reading the New York Times yesterday. Some people are now saying they're using this as an excuse. They don't have to raise rates so much, but they're saying, you know, they're hiding behind that, so to speak, and using it as an excuse to make even more money. Is that fair?
Yeah, there is some of that. And, you know, a lot of in a lot of states, the insurance commissioners had insurance companies file two sets of rates. One, that if they were going to have these cost sharing subsidies paid back, and one if they weren't. And it was about a 20% difference. But of course, we still don't know. Congress didn't resolve it. They didn't come to a deal to appropriate this money. So I think in most cases, they had to lock in. And I think most of them locked in at the higher level. So in many places, rates are basically 20% higher than they would have been if Congress had been able to come to this deal to just assure that this money that the federal government owes the insurance companies was paid. This is not a gift. It's not a bailout. This is just basically a pass-through. This was something the law said that low and moderate income people would get this help paying for their out-of-pocket cost. Insurance companies would be the ones to deliver it. The federal government would pay back the insurance company. So this is something the insurance companies are required to do. And in theory, the federal government is required to give them back the money.
So these are the cost-sharing reductions, the CSRs. We've heard a lot about. President Trump has called them a bailout for insurers.
A lot of Republicans have.
So, but you're saying these go through the insurance companies to the individual sort of moderate or low-income person who needs help paying for their insurance on these individual markets. That's right.
They go up to people with 250% of poverty. So it's people at the lower end, but not the people who are so poor that they can get Medicaid. And, you know, what we've seen in these insurance products is that a lot of them have very high deductibles in the thousands of dollars. So even if you can afford your insurance and you get help paying your premiums, you can't use your insurance if you have a $6,000 deductible. So this is to help people pay that $6,000 deductible.
And again, not a lot of Americans are talking about. 17 million people. Most people get their insurance still through their employers or Medicare or Medicaid, and their rates are slated to go up a small amount, it sounds like, Julie.
That's right.
Just to clarify
that's
that.
Right.
Because there's a lot of scary headlines about, you know, rates blowing through the roof, but that's not everybody. In fact,
there
it's not
are.
Most
Although,
people.
The 17 million people, that's the entire individual market. So you've got then, I think it's about 10 or 11 people in the exchanges, and then you've got 6 or 7 million people sort of outside the exchanges. It's that 6 or 7 million people who are really paying the entirety of these increases. People inside the exchanges are protected to some extent because they're getting help paying their premiums, and it's linked to their income. So if their income doesn't go up, pretty much neither does their premiums.
Again, today in the exchange, it's the politics of healthcare. Julie Rovner is helping us out, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She spent 16 years at NPR as health policy correspondent. Julie also hosts a podcast called What the Health? We've linked to her podcast and her stories on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. You can join us now with a question, comment, observation about all the confusing healthcare politics on Capitol Hill And as we're hearing from Julie at the state level, join us 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org, or again, 1-800-892-6477. And Julie, let's hear from Melissa in Concord. Hi, Melissa, you're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Thank you. I would like to hear more about helping families handle the exorbitant costs of prescription drugs. For example, the federal 340B program that was established in the 90s with the intent to provide discounted drugs to the uninsured and vulnerable patients. But the evidence suggests that the benefits of this program are actually going to the hospitals and the large pharmacy chains and are not being passed on to the consumer. So I wanted to ask your guest if she's aware of any efforts to reform the 340B program.
Oh, thank you so much, Melissa, for the question. And she's right. For some people, it's not so much, you know, going to see the doctor. It's paying for the medicines that he or she prescribes.
Yeah, there are an awful lot of ways that people keep talking about doing something about prescription drug prices. They are going up in many cases, you know, astronomically. They're increasing again as a percentage of health costs that are paid. And interestingly, both Democrats and Republicans have said they want to do something about it, but they've been sort of busy doing other things, working on, you know, Republicans were working on trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Democrats don't have any power in Congress. The 340B program is a good example. There have been the caller explained it very well. This was a program intended to give hospitals that serve low-income patients and community health centers discounts on drugs. Medicaid already gets a discount on drugs. In the case of Medicaid, that discount pretty much gets passed through to the patient because the patient doesn't pay very much under Medicaid. But in the case of the 340B drugs, the discounts don't always sort of accrue to the people they were intended to accrue to. And it is something that Congress is looking at, but Congress is looking at lots of things on drug prices, and there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of movement beyond people saying, yeah, we really want to do something about drug prices.
Yeah, and I remember early in his administration, President Trump said we were going to do something about drug prices. I think we did a whole show on that. What's the holdup, Julie? I mean, why is this so difficult to get our hands around?
Well, the drug industry is powerful. That's one reason that, you know, they don't want, they're worried about keeping, not so much keeping their profits. There are different parts of the drug industry. That's the other piece of this. You had the, you know, sort of the Martin Shkreli's of the world, the people who've gotten into drugs not because they want to help mankind by making new drugs, but because they want to make a quick buck. So you've got sort of drug makers who aren't sort of the old traditional line drug makers. And because it does cost a lot of money to develop drugs, and the United States is the only country that doesn't limit how much drugs cost, is basically where drug companies make the, or so they say, they make the profits that they need to continue to develop new drugs, and that everybody, every other country that does control the cost of drugs is free riding off the United States. So it is complicated. We see it popping up in some of these trade agreements about intellectual property and drug prices. It's not simple, but also there's been a lot more talk than action on Capitol Hill. It's something everybody talks about and nobody seems to do very much about.
Well, Melissa, thank you so much for bringing that up and for calling in. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Julie, let's talk a little bit more about the insurance companies and their political clout and their political activity around some of these repeal and replace efforts. What have they been saying on Capitol Hill? You talked earlier about the insurance commissioners and governors. What do insurers tell Congress that they want?
They basically are saying the same thing as the insurance commissioners. This series of hearings that the Senate Health Committee had in September were sort of remarkable for how consistent the message was. It was, give us certainty on the CSRs, these cost-sharing reductions. Make it easier for states to get some of these waivers where they can sort of do what they want and maybe coordinate with between the waivers from the Affordable Care Act and the waivers for Medicaid and let us do those things together. Those were sort of the two messages that pretty much everybody had. And, of course, the insurance industry also wants to, if there's going to be an individual mandate or requirement for people to have insurance, that they should enforce that not enforcing that will really crash the individual market. It's the least popular thing about the Affordable Care Act, but basically that was the deal that the insurance industry cut back in 2010. It says, we will accept everybody, we will charge them the same. So we will take in sick people and we will pay for their costs, but you have to help us make sure that we get healthy people to offset those costs. And the way you get healthy people is by requiring people to have insurance. So that was the deal. And if you take half the deal out, then insurance companies say, we can't make enough money we can't cover these people, or what's happening now. Instead, we're going to charge so much money that many healthy people just won't be able to afford it. And we're basically making de facto high risk pools. So basically the only people who will be buying individual insurance are the people who know that they're going to need it. And that's not very tenable for the insurance industry. I was a little bit surprised. We were all a little bit surprised at how strongly the insurance industry came out against the last couple of versions of the Obamacare repeal, if you will, that would have basically done things that the insurance industry said would have crashed the insurance market. Some of these block grants where you just sort of put all this money together, give it to the states, but then cut it off after 7 years. And the insurance industry said that simply wouldn't work.
Well, and you talked earlier about the political clout of the pharmaceutical companies. What about the insurance companies? How much political clout do they have?
They still have a fair bit. I would say at this point, possibly not as much as the drug companies, but that's only, a matter of degree. They're still pretty powerful. It was difficult for them. They didn't really want to be too outspoken on the Republican efforts to repeal and replace, because they were so busy worrying about sort of the immediate stability. But they really did come out sort of, there was a dramatic letter at the very end of the debate that was signed not just by the insurance industry, but by the hospital industry, by the American Medical Association. I mean, sort of three really powerful groups that don't tend to agree with each other on the lot. But they said, in this one letter, it came out on a Saturday night just before everything sort of crashed and burned early the following week. But they said that this would be really, really damaging to the nation's healthcare system. It was as we say in Washington, it was a very strong letter. But it was sort of remarkable that you had all of those groups that strongly. Usually the more groups you get on a letter, the weaker the letter it is.
Sure.
This is one of those that was really strong, and it was basically from the entire healthcare community.
Well, let's hear from Joan. She's calling in from Jackson, New Hampshire. Hi, Joan. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Sure.
Yeah, I'm a retiree of Eversource, the parent of our public service company in New Hampshire. And last year, Eversource pushed all their retirees onto the exchanges. They set up a health reimbursement account for us and are contributing, but we are now part of the exchanges, all us retirees. And that's quite a crew of people up here in New England, especially.
So, Joan, you're not old enough for Medicare?
Even the Medicare people have to get their supplemental plans or their advantage plans through the exchanges to participate in the health reimbursement accounts. So, yeah, there's a whole crew of people who are not Medicare eligible yet, and the whole crew of people who are Medicare eligible now are on the exchanges getting their supplemental or advantage plans. And so that crew of 17 million people is actually expanding.
And, oh, wow.
I know Eversource is not the only company out there that has taken this action as a cost-saving measure.
Well, thank you, Joan, for the call, and I'm sorry to hear about what happened. Julie, we're heading into a break, but very quickly, the idea of people who aren't quite old enough for Medicare but, really need some coverage.
Well, and that was what was supposed to happen. If the exchanges were working better, this would be a fine thing, that the idea that people would be sort of sent out to the exchanges. I should clarify that you can't get Medicare supplemental on the exchanges. You can get it separately. I assume that's what's happening, that the Medicare supplemental plans are sold in a different place. The exchanges are just for people who are buying comprehensive individual insurance. But for that pre-Medicare group, that's what's happening in a lot of places. It was thought that many more businesses would send their employees out to the exchanges if they were too small to have to cover them themselves.
All right. Well, thank you, Joan, and good luck to you. More on the politics of healthcare in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Help pay for high-quality journalism in New Hampshire by becoming a new NHPR sustaining member at just $10 a month. As our thanks, we'll send you a special thank you gift, an NHPR mug, and a pair of NHPR socks that both feature the majestic purple finch. Setting up your sustaining gift is quick and easy to do at nhpr.org. And thanks.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, Julie Rovner of Kaiser Health News helps us wade through the politics of healthcare. With repeal and replace off the table for now, we're finding out what's happening with the regulations and the financing of the Affordable Care Act. Also, why premiums are predicted to go way up for some people in some states and far less for others. Let's get your questions and comments in, your observations, your concerns. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Julie, let's talk a little bit more about repeal and replace. As you've been saying, off the table for now. How come? What happened to these efforts? They were pretty robust. They went on for a long time.
They did go on for a long time. Basically, the Republicans only have 52 seats in the Senate, and most bills in the Senate can be filibustered. And if they get filibustered, they require 60 votes. So there's one way that the Senate can pass bills without a filibuster, and that's part of the budget process. And it's governed by a budget resolution, which is limited by the fiscal year. So they passed a budget resolution. It was late. It was due last year. Passed a budget resolution in January that basically gave them the ability to pass to repeal and replace parts of the law. They couldn't reach the whole law because everything in that bill has to be budget related, but they could use that budget bill to basically do something new with only 50 votes in the Senate. And that expired at the end of the fiscal year, which was September 30th. So now we're into a new fiscal year. They haven't done the budget resolution for this fiscal year, which, by the way, was due last April. But the anticipation is that the budget resolution that's being worked on, even as we speak, for fiscal 2018 will have to do more with taxes. And they could do health care also. It's even more complicated. You can do one tax bill and one spending bill, but so much of what has to do with health care has to do with taxes that there's some concern that taxes will be hard enough without trying to bundle it with health care. So they're going to do just taxes for this budget year. If they pass the tax bill, then next year they can do another budget resolution. They could go back to health care if they wanted to. That next budget resolution is due next April. So they would have, a few months, more than 6 months before the 2018 elections if they get taxes done and they want to go back and try take another bite at health care.
Yeah, I saw one of the senators quoted in one of these repeal and replace efforts. I think it was Senator Graham saying, it's off the table for now, but we can always come back with this next year. Why weren't they able, Julie, to get over that final hurdle? This has been very important, agree or disagree. This has been very important for the Republican Party. They've been working hard on it. So why were they unable to sort of take that final step and make it happen?
Well, the dirty little secret is that they didn't have 50 votes. The president keeps complaining about the filibuster, but they didn't need to break a filibuster. They only needed to get 50 votes. Republicans have agreed for the last 7 years that they want to, quote unquote, repeal and replace Obamacare. But they never really went deeper than that because fundamentally, they're just as divided about health care as Democrats are. Democrats, are divided between the idea of Medicare for all and something more incremental like the Affordable Care Act. Republicans are divided between total free market, get the government completely out of health care, and sort of the more incremental. Remember, the Affordable Care Act was originally a Republican idea. It was based on what happened in Massachusetts under then Governor Mitt Romney. So you've got some more moderate Republicans who want to just sort of clean up what was going on in the Affordable Care Act. And you've got the conservative Republicans who want to make all government and health care go away. And they couldn't find 50 votes among them on anything that they agreed with.
So it's basically Rand Paul of Kentucky versus Lisa Murkowski of Alaska.
And Susan Collins.
Of Maine. Right.
And Ted Cruz of Texas. I mean, in this case, it ultimately became Rand Paul versus Susan Collins. But there is, there's three or four, as you mentioned, sort of more moderate Republicans, and there's three or four way more conservative Republicans. And when you only have 52 total, and then you had John McCain in there saying that the process was really terrible, where this budget bill is supposed to go through committee, and they just didn't bother in the Senate. It did go through committee in the House briefly. But in the Senate, they just skipped the committees, and that upset a lot of senators because the committees is where a lot of these, details get fleshed out, and they have debates and they have hearings, and you get to hear from the stakeholders, and that didn't happen in the Senate, and that upset a number of senators who we never really quite heard from, you know, at the end, but I know Jerry Moran of Kansas talked about it at home. Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, before he was a co-sponsor of the last-ditch bill, complained about that. So there were a whole host of problems that made it very difficult. Whether they can get to 50 next year, you know, with pretty much this same cast of Republicans, also still a pretty open question.
Well, so, and we'll talk about divides within the Democratic Party in a minute on this, because that's real interesting too. But one more question about the Republicans, Julie. So the Rand Pauls of the world, what is it that they don't like about the Affordable Care Act? And then the Lamar Alexanders of the world, what is it that they don't like about the Affordable Care Act?
Well, the Rand Pauls of the world say that the federal government has no business being involved in health care. Now, the problem with that is the federal government is about half of all health care spending now between
Medicare,
you know,
Medicaid, the VA.
Medicaid, exactly, the VA, the Federal Employees Health Plan. That's 9 million people by itself, although I don't think he wants to necessarily get rid of that. But, you know, the federal government and the federal government has much to say about lots of other things. And particularly in the Affordable Care Act, there's a lot of federal regulation of individual health insurance. So the libertarian/Republicans really want to get the Republican Party as far out of health care, or want to get the federal government as far out of health care as possible. That frightens people, you know, like Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, many of whose Republican constituents depend on the federal government for their health care. Medicare is popular. Medicaid is surprisingly popular, even though, you know, it's quote unquote for poor people. There's a lot of middle class people who benefit from Medicaid, if only because it's paying for nursing home care for their elderly parents that otherwise they wouldn't be able to afford. So there's a lot of Republicans who recognize that federal health spending is important to the people who vote for them. And that is a very difficult divide.
Well, I want to turn to Democrats in just a moment, but let's go back to our listeners. Again, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're getting an expansive overview of the politics of healthcare on Capitol Hill and in state capitals, what governors and insurance commissioners have been saying. Lots of confusion, lots going on. Julie Rovner is helping us out, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Again, the number for you to join us with your comments, concerns, personal experiences, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. And Julie, to Northampton, where Guy is on the line. Hi, Guy. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. I'd just like to come back to some comments that Julie made about the individual market and the scale of the problem. As I understand it, the essence of the objective of the ACA was to, you know, deal with the uninsured. So it really is the individual market that's important here rather than the employer market. And I get my insurance on the individual market, so I have some personal experience of it. She characterized the problem of the 40% of the 17 million who are not subsidized but facing, you know, a really tough economic problem.
Right.
It's quite a small problem. That doesn't strike me as being a fair characterization, because it's not taking into account all of the other people who simply cannot afford insurance and now are being penalized with the penalties under the Affordable Care Act. To put it into sort of broad numerical perspective, imagine you are a New Hampshire family with an income in, the say, the $100,000 region, which is a very good income in the state, well above the median and well above the average, but it takes you outside any prospect of subsidy in the insurance market. If you are looking at a family policy, you will typically be looking at $20,000 a year of premiums.
Wow.
With that, you will have a $12,000 deductible.
Now, that's huge, Guy.
Yes, and that may be for slightly older people, like my wife and myself. But in the context of, you know, the family budget, that is a huge number. So to me, it's not at all surprising that many people who are above those subsidy thresholds are simply saying, this is unaffordable.
Right.
And most people don't see these numbers because they get their insurance from their employer and they'll do that little copay, or there'll be some contribution to that. But there's another factor as well that needs to be borne in mind, which is that currently under tax law, if you receive health insurance from your employer, that's a non-taxable benefit. If you're in the individual market and you're paying an individual premium, that is not a tax-deductible expense against your income. So, at least as I understand it, I'm not an expert in this area, but those are the kinds of factors and numbers that I have seen in my personal experience.
Sure, Guy. Well, you're feeling the pain there. And certainly, even though, Julie, as you said, it's a smaller group of people, people in that group like Guy are really seeing a bite out of their income. Guy, I'm so glad you called. Julie, he gives us, you know, a sense of just how steep this is for some people.
Oh, absolutely. I'm actually working on this story right now, so I know how big the problem is. And that's what I was trying to say. It is small for this small number of people. It is an enormous problem. And I should and Guy is right that there are captured in that 17 million are people who simply have dropped out because they can't afford it. And in fact, just last year, the individual market was closer to 20 million people. So there's sort of 2.5 million people. But again, in the context of 330 million Americans, it's a relatively small percentage who are being impacted by this. But the people who are being impacted by this are being impacted in a very large way. That is not to end it. And it's true. People who earn just too much, the people that I've been talking to about this, they know exactly where that threshold is. They know that, you know, 400% of poverty for an individual is about $64,000. And, you know, there's talk about, well, whether they're trying to make, you know, trying to get under that amount to get some subsidy. And also there are a number of people now, there's a threshold beyond which you don't have to pay the penalty. So in some cases, people are not having to pay the penalty, even though they earn more than 400% of poverty, because health insurance has gotten so expensive that it's a higher percentage of their income than the law requires them to pay for insurance. So yeah, so for those people, it's really not a good situation. And if I can clarify that, the tax consequence, he's absolutely right that if you get health insurance on the job, you don't pay taxes on the value of that, and your employer gets to write it off as an expense. If you're self-employed and you file a Schedule C, then you can also deduct the cost of your health insurance premiums. The people who are hurt because they have no tax benefit are the people who work for somebody else, but that somebody else doesn't provide them insurance. So they're an employee rather than self-employed. They have to pay their own health insurance premiums, and they get no tax benefit from that.
Well, Guy, thank you for calling. And we've linked to Julie's stories and her podcast on our website, so you can check it out. It's NHPR Exchange. So check out all of Julie's work on this issue and others on our website. Thank you so much for the call, Guy. Here's an email that just came in, Julie, from Karen, who says, I lived in Europe and got a pre-existing condition, so was a healthcare exile until the ACA. Then I was finally able to come home. I'm a freelancer and earn too much money to get a subsidy, and I'm too young for Medicare. Now I pay almost $600 a month and understand that my premiums will almost double. I can barely afford what I'm paying now for lots worse care than I had in Europe. Will there be help for people like me? This Karen in Manchester. Sounds like Karen's in kind of the same situation as Guy, Julie.
That's right. And, you know, these are the people who are in this, you know, 7 or 8 million, you know, so it's not an insignificant number. And Congress knows about these people. I mean, what's been sort of surprising about the debate this year is that the Republicans did a really good job at describing the problem. And there are problems. This is a very dysfunctional piece of something that was supposed to help people afford their health insurance. And obviously, for this small number of people, it is not working. But what sort of none of the Republicans' plans would have really addressed these people's problems. In some cases, they might have been able to buy much less insurance. That is still a possibility. And some people are doing that. And they're either going outside the Affordable Care Act and buying short-term policies and paying the fine. Or, as I mentioned, in some cases, insurance in their state has gotten so expensive that they don't have to pay the fine. But this was not how this was supposed to work. And there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of effort to fix this particular problem.
Karen, thank you for the email. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Julie, what about the bipartisan health bill that we hear Senators Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray, Republican and a Democrat, are working on? What does that look like?
Well, they're still talking about it the last time I checked, which was yesterday afternoon. you know, the problem is it's quite possible that Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray can get a deal. They have worked together successfully on a lot of bipartisan legislation. The question is, if they get a deal, will they be able to sell that deal
right
to the rest of the Senate and to the House? I mean, we've already heard, as you mentioned, that there are a lot of Republicans who consider these cost-sharing reduction, you know, payments to be bailouts to the insurance industry and want no part of it. Now, the Democrats very much want to do this, but the Republicans are in charge and they get to decide whether this comes to the floor or not. And the president would have to sign it unless they had enough votes to override. I think it's the problem is more likely to be in the Congress than with the president. I suspect the president would sign anything that came to him if it had, you know, one Republican vote on either side, and call it a day. But whether they can, you know, A, come to a deal, and B, get it through both houses of Congress, still a very open question.
I often hear this bill described, Julie, as limited. So why is it limited?
It is limited because it's going to be hard enough to get anything through, and you know, Chairman Alexander said he wanted it to be as small as possible. So basically what they're talking about is for the Democrats and for the health industry, not just the health insurance industry, some assurance on these cost-sharing reductions. And everyone asked, you know, originally Senator Alexander said he would guarantee them for 1 year, but everybody said, no, we really need to guarantee them for 2 years because next spring insurance companies will start doing, you know, setting up their plans for the following year. So 2 years of assurance on the cost-sharing reductions. And then for the Republicans, some kind of additional flexibility for states to waive some of the rules. There's already a waiver process in the Affordable Care Act. People complain that it's much too stringent, but Democrats don't want Republican states to be able to waive all of the protections. So that's what the discussion is how could they make those waivers easier to use while still keeping people protected by to make sure that they have adequate coverage.
So expanding the cost-sharing reductions or the subsidies for people
guaranteeing them, not expanding them.
Just
making sure they're going to get paid.
For 2 years. So that doesn't help people, though, like our emailer Karen, our caller Guy, right, Julie?
Nope. It does not. You know, and the only thing that would help people, you know, perhaps if it was a little bit easier, one of the things that states are doing with these waivers is they're doing what's called reinsurance, which they're setting up pools so that the most expensive patients, the insurance companies wouldn't be responsible for those bills. If that were to happen, and we've seen this in some of the states that have tried the reinsurance, then premiums come down as a whole. That would help these people who are not getting premium subsidies because premiums would come down. That kind of thing would help them. Other types of waivers also might help them. But no, there's really not very much. There's not very many policy ideas for helping these people who, as I said, the Republicans have described fairly well, the people who simply, you know, can't afford these premiums. And if they can't afford the premiums, they can't afford to use their insurance because the out-of-pocket costs are so high.
So the only thing that this Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray bill addresses is these subsidies, these cost-sharing reductions. That's it.
Well, and possibly the reinsurance, the waivers. But remember, in the absence of the cost-sharing reductions, premiums will go up another 20%. Mm. So, and again, it's the unsubsidized people who will see that. So basically, doing this will prevent a 20% increase for some of these people.
State by state, this varies a lot. You mentioned that earlier, too, Julie.
That's right. You know, it depends on the state of the market, how many insurers there are, the health of the population, how much providers cost. I mean, that's the biggest thing. It's, you know, if you're in a place where there's one hospital and they can dictate their prices, insurance is going to be more expensive. If you're in a place where there's sort of robust hospital competition and insurers can sort of play them off against each other, then you may have lower premiums. So, yeah, healthcare prices are extremely local.
Well, coming up, we've been talking a lot about Republicans, repeal and replace, some of the divides within the GOP on healthcare. Coming up, we will take a turn with the Democrats. As you mentioned earlier, Julie, lots of different opinions in the Democratic Party as well about the way forward on healthcare. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, untangling the politics of healthcare on Capitol Hill and the role state insurance commissioners and governors are trying to play, given huge uncertainty in the individual healthcare market. Julie Rovner is our guest, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. And we'd love to hear from you, your comments, questions, concerns, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. exchange.org, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Julie, we've spent a lot of time looking at Republican efforts to repeal and replace and some of the issues around that and some of the divisions within Republicans themselves, especially in the Senate. We've talked about Rand Paul, Lamar Alexander, you know, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Lindsey Graham. Let's look at the Democrats. Bernie Sanders, about a month ago, made a big splash with his latest Medicare for All bill. What would that bill do, Julie?
Well, basically, it would get rid of the private insurance market. And it would say all insurance is going to be provided, it's going to be paid for by the federal government, the way Medicare is. I mean, that Medicare, the way Medicare works is that hospitals and doctors are private, but the federal government pays most of the bills. As we talked earlier, there are supplemental insurance that you could buy. This would be even more federal than that. There would be no more supplemental insurance. Basically, the federal government would pay everybody's health care costs in full. Most people think that's probably not a realistic idea, either at this point or even in the near future, since that's not even what Medicare does. But that's the proposal. And it's not new. I tweeted when he introduced the bill. I went home and dug through my files because I'm neurotic about keeping paper and found that because I had files that were not digitized. And I found the press release from the first single payer press conference I went to that was in March of 1993, at the beginning of the consideration of President Clinton's health care bill. There was a big single payer movement. And I will point out that Bernie Sanders, who was then in the House, was a part of that. He wasn't the lead sponsor, but he's been for this for a long time.
So Medicare for All basically means a single payer system. How much traction is this getting among Democrats, Julie?
A lot. There's been sort of a muttering undercurrent for some sort of, you know, Medicare for All for quite a while, as I point out, at least in 1993. I think it went back a little bit before that. It had been significant in the Democratic Party, but if you polled on it, it was never, you know, this was sort of the frustration. And I get lots of single payer people coming at me all the time. And I said, you know, the problem with single payer is that you're a plurality, but you've never come close to a majority. Well, what's interesting is that more recent polling, I think, with the frustrations with the healthcare system, is it is coming closer to a majority, but it's not there yet. It's not even hard to know if it's there in the Democratic Party. And there was some actually muttering under people's breaths that Bernie Sanders introduced this at a very inopportune time. It helped sort of pour fuel on that last-ditch Republican effort, because they were able to say, look, if you don't do this, then we're going to have single payer. Well, of course, we're not going to have single payer anytime soon. You've got Republicans in charge of the House, the Senate, and the White House, at least for now. The question is whether this will become kind of a litmus test for Democrats, whether Democrats will demand this. And if they demand it, whether they'll demand sort of this dramatic a change. I mean, there are other ways to do a Medicare for All. You could have a buy-in. You could do it gradually. There have been a couple of states that have tried to do this, and they found, you know, particularly Vermont and California, and they have found that it would be such a disruption and the tax increase would be so huge that people basically wouldn't stand for it. So I think a lot of people think eventually we might get there. The United States is still pretty much the only country that doesn't guarantee everybody health insurance. The question is, how do you get there?
Yeah, and Vermont is often held up as sort of exhibit A as to why this doesn't work. We did a whole program on it when that was going on, and Governor Peter Shumlin was in favor of it, then Governor Peter Shumlin, and I think he ended up saying, Julie, you know, we can't afford it.
That's right. Well, it wasn't so much they can't afford it, it's that they just couldn't do it. I mean, it just, and of course, Vermont has sort of unique problems. I've spent some time in Vermont, and I know that a lot of Vermonters get their health care in New Hampshire or in New York. So there, you know, that is another difficulty. It would be very difficult for a state to do it. California, obviously, a little bit less dependent on its neighbors for health care. But even in California, it was basically the same problem that, you know, when you got down to paying for it, because as we talked about earlier, so much of the money comes from the federal government and states can't reach that, it would be really difficult for any one state to do this. I think if it's going to happen, it's going to have to happen at a federal level. Now, that's not to say there are a number of countries that have sort of a joint state-federal healthcare universal system. Canada for one, Switzerland for another. There are a lot where the states, or, you know, in this case, the provinces or the cantons, have a lot of say over how healthcare is regulated, but it's the umbrella comes from the federal government.
So a litmus test for Democrats coming up, just like we talked about Republicans. You know, do you want to completely repeal and replace? Do you want to sort of fix around the edges. For Democrats, the litmus test is, do you support Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All or don't you? That's what we're going to hear. Well, and in our own state, Senator Shaheen was a supporter of Senator Sanders' bill, whereas Senator Hassan was not. So we've got a divide right here among Democrats in our own state. Back to our listeners, Julie, lots of people who want to jump in. And Jenny's calling from Manchester. Hi, Jenny. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The issue that I want to raise that I have never heard anyone talk about are people like me. I'll give you the quick down and dirty. I was a first responder. I spent nearly 20 years of my life taking care of people, saving lives, and doing all that I could for them. I got breast cancer. The cancer they got, but the cure destroyed my body the point where I can no longer be a first responder. So I was forced onto Medicare. After you're out of work for 2 years, you get the card in the mail, and if you don't hold on to it, you lose it. So you got to keep that card. Well, then it comes time to sign up for insurance. And at the time, I didn't know anything about it. I took whatever I could get and went on. Last year, I went in for renewal. Mutual of Omaha turned me down. The reason? Pre-existing condition. Under Obamacare, under the Affordable Care Act, whatever the heck you want to call it, there is an exemption for Medicare health insurance products.
Oh, my goodness.
They are allowed to absolutely, yes.
So you're not protected.
I'm not protected at all. And here's the kicker. I'm only allowed access to a supplemental plan. I have a very rare form of post-mastectomy syndrome that science doesn't even know why it happens. I was number 3 out of 29 years of my surgeon's history to get this.
Don't you love being a special case right there? Oh, that's so frustrating. And Julie and Jenny, I'm sorry. In the interest of time, I need to let you go. And I just feel terrible. She spent so much time helping other people survive from, you know, who knows what, car accidents and so forth. So pre-existing conditions. Now, under the Affordable Care Act, Julie, these people were supposed to be protected, and this is one area where I have heard Republicans and Democrats say, yes, 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 it's not fair to shut out people with pre-existing conditions.
Well, this is a quirk of Medicare, and it's a quirk of Medicare for people who are under 65. If you're over 65, when you become eligible for Medicare, you can buy whatever supplemental plan you want. And this is important to go back to the whole Medicare for All. Unlike what Bernie Sanders is talking about, Medicare doesn't cover all of people's bills. In fact, it doesn't cover much more than half. If you have Medicaid and Medicare, then you can get your bills paid. Most people need some kind of supplemental insurance to pay the rest of what Medicare doesn't. If you are under 65, when you become eligible for Medicare via disability, as the caller did, it is harder to get this supplemental insurance. And as she discovered, you can, I think there's, like Medicare, there's one chance to get it. And if you don't keep it, then you can't buy it again. I'm pretty sure when she turned 65, she'd be able to get it again. But obviously, it sounds like she's a long way from 65. It's a problem. Again, it's a small number of people, but the people that it affects in a huge way.
Well, Jenny, I'm really sorry to hear your story. I don't know if what we're saying is helpful. I wonder if you can call the insurance commissioner's agency. There's a lot of good, knowledgeable people over there, so maybe they can help you. And best wishes to you. Sorry.
This is really a Medicare problem.
This is
a Medicare issue, not a. This is not something the state can help with. This is something that the federal government.
Can help okay.
With. It's a Medicare problem.
All right. Well, Jenny, best of luck to you. Here's another email that just came in from Jeffrey, who says, "Has there ever been a study to find out how much money America spends in total per year on health insurance costs, including Medicare, Medicaid, the VA, versus," Jeffrey asks, "how much it would cost to put everybody on Medicare?" So this is Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All, Julie. Has anybody looked at those numbers?
Yes. Nobody's very happy with the numbers that have come out. There's a lot problems with how you would estimate this. I think the general thought, and this is probably true, is that, you know, if you actually got it, once you would have it sort of implemented, that overall there would be less spending on a program where everybody's covered for everything than right now when we have so many different insurers and so many administrative costs. However, if you were to do it the way Bernie Sanders is talking about doing it, where there is absolutely no cost sharing by patients, so everything is free, that produces what economists call induced demand. People would probably use more health care than they would otherwise. And so it might cost, if not more, possibly close to as much. And that's sort of the big argument about how you estimate these things. It's difficult. I don't think anybody really thinks that we're going to end up with a plan that gives no country gives everybody everything for free, even England. Or if you do, then you have to basically ration care, because there otherwise our economy would basically be all health care. The trick is to find the amount that helps people get the right amount of care. It doesn't block them financially from getting care that they need, but it doesn't encourage them to just go get care because it's all free.
Well, thank you for the email, Jeffrey, and again for the call, Jenny. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So here's another email that came in from Lisa in Newmarket, who says, there are indeed flaws with the individual market. Lisa says, so why did Republicans include provisions that would radically transform Medicaid, which became a deal breaker for people like Senator Collins? Lisa, thank you so much. This is a really important point, Julie, and we haven't talked that much about Medicaid and Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. Our emailer, Lisa, is absolutely right. This is a huge piece of the law that, you know, governors and insurance commissioners, a lot of them kind of like it because it helped them cover a whole new group of people.
It did. And, you know, there were two pieces to Medicaid. There was the original underlying Medicaid program that helps low income people who, as people like to, you had to be poor and something. So it was poor and a pregnant woman, poor and a child, poor and someone with a disability, poor and a senior citizen. What the Affordable Care Act did is it said you just had to be poor. You just had to have income under 138% of poverty. And so that was the expansion. But what the bills, the emailers write, what the Republican bills would have done is it not only would have taken away the expansion, it would have rolled back the Medicaid program in general. It would have capped it and told states that you can only, that the federal government is no longer going to provide an open-ended commitment to provide medical care to low-income people in your state. That we're going to give you, you're going to have lots of flexibility. You can do whatever you want, but we're going to give you less money to do it with. This is something Republicans have wanted to do since the 1980s. It had nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act. It had everything to do with saving enough money that they could put to other tax cuts elsewhere.
Wow, Julie, I can't believe it. We have run out of time, and there's so much more we could talk about and so much more input from our listeners. So I guess my last question is, you know, what next with this repeal and replace?
Well, we're waiting to see if this bipartisan bill happens. We never talked about the Children's Health Insurance Program, which also expired over the weekend. Congress is trying to get back up and running. That's 9 million kids. So, you know, healthcare continues as an issue.
Well, and our conversation always continues online on Facebook, so folks can jump in there as well and continue to participate. Julie Rovner, we'll have to have you back. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
That's Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She spent 16 years at NPR. She hosts a podcast that we'll link to called What the Health. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.